On the roll for the Budget and Finance Committee meeting of February 26, 2020, Director Abe-Koga, Director Canepa, Director Chavez, Director Cutter, Director Hudson, Director Ju, Director Mitoff, Director Ross, Director Wagenknecht, Committee Vice Chair Bowders, Committee Chair Groom, Board Chair Sinks, we have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. Marcy, do we have public comment for non-agenda matters?
No.
Okay. This time we're going to move to the minutes. Is there any questions or comments? If not, I'll take a motion.
I'll move the minutes. I'll second.
There's a motion by Director Wagenknecht, a second by Director Canepa. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, all abstaining, passes unanimously by members present. Item four, members, by the way, I'm going to take item seven ahead of item six today in the interest of time to ensure that we hear the prelude to the budget today. Item four is the Air District's financial audit report for fiscal year ending 2019.
Thank you, Chair Bowders. For the second year, we've enjoyed having Simpson Simpson as our annual auditors, and Mr. Joe Musa will provide the presentation.
Thank you. Welcome. Can we get the mic on?
Good morning, members of the committee and also members of the Air District. My name is Joe Musa, partner with Simpson & Simpson CPAs, and we'll be presenting to the committee today the results of our financial and single audit as of June 30, 2019. So the reason why we're here today is actually a requirement by our standards, which is SAS 114, Statement on Auditing Standards, which require us to come to the governing board of an entity to present to them the results of our audit. So we'll be looking at the required communications. We'll talk very briefly about the results in terms of the hard numbers as of June 30, 2018. We'll discuss the results of the single audit, which is the federal compliance, and then we'll end it off with questions if necessary. So our responsibility under SAS 114 is to plan the audit in a very efficient manner. Okay, so one of the very important things that we do is we review the Air District's internal controls. We look at areas that are necessary and applicable to the financial audit. We do that to prepare that efficient and effective audit approach, but we don't do that for the purposes of providing any assurances on internal control. So we take those internal controls, we assess them, and what we do is we design and implement audit procedures. The overall intent of our audit is to assure the governing board and provide a reasonable assurance that the financial statements are free from material misstatement. Okay, so that's one of the main purposes of what we're doing when we're looking at the financial audit. We also perform tests of compliance with certain provisions of law and regulations to make sure that the Air District are up to speed in terms of code. And then ultimately, the most important thing is we provide an opinion on the financial statement. So kind of just to cut to the chase, the opinion over the Air District's financial statements was an unmodified opinion, which kind of in our lingo is the cleanest level of an opinion that an entity can obtain as a result of their financial statement audit. Now other areas that we're responsible for looking at the Air District's significant accounting policies, ensure that those are in accordance to generally accepted accounting principles. We would like to present to the committee that those were in accordance to GAAP. Also, there were no changes in any of the policies from the prior year, and all significant transactions have been recorded in the financial statements in the proper period. Other areas of sensitivity are accounting estimates, which we review significant accounting estimates which may have a material impact on your financial statements. Those would be related to useful life of your capital assets, liability accruals for legal cases. And then also, one of the big ticket items on your financial statements are your OPEB liabilities and your net pension liabilities, the deferred inflows and outflows that come associated with those items. CalPERS and McLeod-Watts plays an important role in the analysis of those figures, and we review those to determine that they're reasonable. So in conclusion, for accounting estimates, we'd like to present to the committee that we have determined that all key estimates are reasonable. Corrected misstatements, we did have one proposed audit adjustment related to a legal accrual that the Air District did indeed book. We have no uncorrected misstatements, and we noted no significant deficiencies in internal control. We encountered no disagreements or difficulties. Normally, this comes from the form of a disagreement in terms of an application of an accounting policy or procedure. We had none, and to our knowledge, there were no consultants or other accountants that worked in conjunction with our audit. And then finally, we cap it off with management representations, which we obtained from management on February 3rd, the date of our audit opinion. Now again, kind of reiterating what I noted before, the financial statements received an unmodified opinion with respect to the government activities in each major fund. So very briefly, just looking at some of the overall financial highlights of your government-wide financial statements and fund financial. So your government-wide is very much going to be similar to that of, you know, private sector financial statements. Your fund financials are obviously very government-related in terms of your general and special revenue. So they provide two different kinds of perspectives. Looking at your net position this year, it witnessed an increase of $19.1 million, mainly due to additional air grants and also the purchase of buildings that occurred this year. Looking at your governmental funds, your fund balance increased increased from last year in the amount of $9.6 million, same kind of reason, mainly because of an increase in your air district grants. Looking at your general fund, which is one of the major funds here for the air district, you're going to have about $77.5 million in fund balance that you're going to carry forward to the next year, which we're already in. Of that amount, we have $5.5 million that is restricted, about $0.94 million non-spendable. You have assigned and committed balances of about $29 million, and the remaining $42 million or so was unassigned. Now, looking over our audit opinion, our government auditing standards opinion over internal control, we identified no significant deficiencies or material weaknesses in the Air District's controls related to those that we reviewed, and we identified no instances of noncompliance as it pertains to the financial audit. Now, moving forward to your single audit, we did identify one instance of an inapplication of indirect costs, which was fairly immaterial, which is why it was considered just a significant deficiency on your federal compliance. You'll find that on page 10 of your single audit report for details on that. There were no prior year findings, and in conclusion, we did identify some areas of improvement in your internal controls that we brought to management's attention. They reviewed those and have corrective action plans to implement those in their internal controls moving forward. So with that, I can entertain any questions or comments that any member of the committee may have.
Thank you. Before we do that, my preference is always to invite members of the public to speak. I find, not with these members necessarily, but questions spill into comments quickly. So are there members of the public who wish to speak on this item? Okay, if not, are there questions now for the presentation? Director Sinks.
I was wondering if you could expound a bit on the suggestions that you had and also the substantial adjustment that had been identified.
Sure. Actually, I'll answer your second question first. If I'm understanding the question correctly, it's referring to the federal compliance finding. That was just an application of your indirect costs, where the indirect cost was applied to personnel costs plus fringe. You know, it was communicated by the EPA, which is the Air District's cognitive agency, that you should only apply the indirect cost over just personnel costs. So it came up to about a 30K difference, and the Air District has plans to put that money back, you know, and to be able to fix that error. So they have corrective action plans in place for that. With regards to a management letter, those are essentially what we call control deficiencies at a very low level. They don't rise to the level of significant deficiencies. They don't materially impact the financial statements. But what we like to do as external auditors is, if we find areas of improvement, we like to bring that up to management's attention. So a few areas were procurement, a couple of procurement policies that we felt could have been consistent with other policies that we compared it against. We looked at a couple of areas in payroll where we felt there could be a little bit stronger segregation of duties, also in the AP function as it pertains to access controls within JDE. So, again, those are suggestions we provided in the form of a memorandum to management. They've provided corrective action responses in terms of how they're going to handle that moving forward. A lot of their responses are going to already be implemented, meaning they've already made changes to be able to strengthen those controls. So definitely, if a copy of that would be requested by the committee, that was provided to management for you guys to take a look at.
I appreciate that. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the corrected misstatement on page 7.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when we look at legal accruals, as auditors and as an entity, your responsibility is to be able to track the overall progress of those cases, right? So what we found as of June 30, 2019, for this specific legal case, there was no resolution. Management of the Air District did not have a firm indication that they were going to have an unfavorable outcome. So based on the information they had when they prepared the financial statements, there was no need for an accrual of a potential loss. Now, kind of fast
forward. This was as of June 30th of last year.
That is correct. Yes, absolutely. Okay. So that, so then what we do in conjunction with management is we reach out to your legal counsel. We get updates on those cases to determine, was there a case that was kind of visible and alive as of June 30, 2019, where the circumstances may have changed where an accrual now becomes necessary? And we found in this specific case, there was a settlement reached in October, which warranted us to then go back to management and say, hey, we need to accrue for this because it was a case that existed as of June 30th. We found information that now changes the stance of the accrual, and we had proposed that adjustment, which of course management did book.
Yeah. Okay, and so the timing of it was management had to state what it thought as of June 30th, and you had an opportunity to review it with management later, and by mutual agreement you made a change because there was an actual event.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly correct.
Yeah, the liability was disclosed. It just wasn't a certain amount, and so it was stated as uncertain. And
so now,
it became certain.
It was appropriate at that time because we didn't have any specific amount to not put any specific amount in because that might influence how we were able to negotiate.
Correct.
Okay. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Director Canepa.
So what I see before us is a clean audit. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep.
Correct.
The unmodified opinion would represent a clean audit. Yes.
Great. Thank you for answering that. I just have a sort of a general question, and it doesn't deserve a long answer. In terms of air districts, are there other air districts throughout the state that you provide audits for?
Yeah, you know, we used to do the financial audit for the South Coast Air Quality Management District about 2 years ago. We did their audit for about 6 years, but they kind of had a decision to make in terms of changing auditors just based on their policies and procedures. But yes, we have done their audit for multiple years in the past.
Just the reason I asked that, I'm glad you answered that. I'm glad you had that experience because I would assume this, as opposed to dealing with other budgets and in other areas, is probably a little bit different, I would assume, in terms of revenues, fees, and
so yeah, South Coast is fairly a little bit bigger here. You know, that shouldn't change our approach, our audit approach, in terms of the amount of testing that we do. Certainly, it changes the materiality, but yes, we have had experience
Great.
In that regard.
Thank you.
I appreciate the question.
Director Ju.
Thank you, Chair Powders. Just wanted to make a formal request through the chair to see if we can get a copy of the memo and the outline of the corrective actions.
Yes. Is it staff? Would it be better to get it from the consultant, or would you have that letter you can share with us? You have it right there. Okay. We'll accept the request from Director June. If we could have staff make copies of that for everybody while we're here, that would be great, and people can take a look at that. Is that acceptable to you? Okay. Are there other questions or comments? Okay. If not, thank you very much for
thank
the presentation.
You.
Thank you, staff, for another year of a clean audit. Okay. We'll move to item 5, the second quarter financial report for fiscal year ending 2020. Jeff.
Thank you. Stephanie Osaz will provide this report.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me make sure I have my presentation. Okay, so today I will be presenting the general fund reporting for the second quarter of the fiscal year, which covers July through December of 2019. I'll provide an overview of the revenues incurred and the revenues recognized and expenditures incurred, as well as the investment balance as of December. I'll go over the general fund balance and outstanding liabilities, and then I'll conclude with our purchasing report. Oops, sorry, wrong way. So this represents the general fund revenues as of December. And as you can see, the total overall revenues is at 67% of the budget. I will highlight a few of these categories. So in terms of our county receipts, we're at 48% of the budget, which is pretty much on target. Some of our permit-related fees are normally billed in the first and second quarter of the fiscal year. So this is pretty much consistent with what we expect for the second half of the year. In terms of our toxic inventory revenue, as you can see, that one is significantly higher than what we initially budgeted. And that's due to the facility-wide health risk assessment that was produced, which showed some health risk impacts from certain facilities were low, therefore reducing the amount of the fees to CARB and allowing the district to retain more of those fees. The last category I want to highlight is our miscellaneous revenue. And again, you see that's a little bit higher than what we initially budgeted. And that's just due to the temporary lease back of our district's Richmond facility to the previous owners. This slide shows the revenue comparison. And so it takes the prior year and the current year for the same period. And when we compare those two periods, you can see that county receipts are higher in 2020. And that's mainly due to just the timing of when the revenues are received by the district. So in 2019, we had two counties where we received the revenues in early January instead of December. So it's just really a timing issue. In terms of our permit fees, you see there's a decrease in 2020. And that's mainly due to the one-time adjustment to some of the fee payers' anniversary date back in 2019. So in 2019, the district had collected an additional 4 months of revenue when we adjusted those anniversary dates. So we're now on a normal 12-month cycle. So that's why you're seeing that reduction. Okay, so now we'll go to our general fund expenditures. And so you can see overall total expenditures is at 49% of our budget. And I'll talk a little bit more about these categories on the next slide. So again, when we look at our expenditure comparison and we compare the two periods, looking at the prior year and the current year, you see that salaries increased in 2019, and that's just due to increased staffing as we fill vacancies. And we also had a 3.5% COLA that was effective July 1st. As you can see, as salaries increase, benefit costs will also increase. And so we have an increase in 2020 related to increased staffing, as well as we had an increase in our unfunded liability payment to CalPERS. For operating services and supplies, we see an increase in 2020, and that's basically just due to timing of when we receive services and we process payments. But in addition to that, we also had that one-time settlement. This next slide shows the investment with San Mateo County. And so as of December, our total cash balance with the county was $300 million, which represents 6% of the $5.9 billion in the county's investment pool. And the interest earned in December was 1.9%. This next slide shows our fund balance and outstanding liabilities. And so here you will see we provided basically three periods, the 2018, the 2019, audited balance, as well as our 2020 projected balance, which is at $45 million. At the bottom of this slide, we also provide the outstanding liabilities for both pension and OPEB, which totaled about $105 million. And then we've also included here our certificate of participation notes, which relates to the interest, estimated interest, and principal payment that's due on a note for the purchase here of our space in this building. And that's totals of about $27 million. So I'll conclude with our purchasing report. And as a part of this quarterly report, we do provide a list of the reoccurring vendor payments that exceed $100,000 without board approval. And this slide shows those lists of vendors that meet this requirement. And again, these are mainly benefit payments for our employees, as well as some utility costs and other services that we do on a day-to-day for our operations. So this concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Thank you. Are there members of the public who wish to speak on this item? Seeing none, directors with questions. Director Chavez.
Thank you very much for the clarity and the report. I just had two questions, and one of them is that I want to make sure I recall the percentage, the economic contingency percentage that our goal was. I just can't remember.
20%.
It is 20%.
Of our general fund budget, yeah.
Got it, okay. And only, and of our general fund budget, how much more would it be if it were our total budget?
Well, if we were to include the pass-throughs for our grants program, that would at least double it.
Okay.
But, of course, we can't really access those funds in that manner.
Yeah, so. No, I understand. I just was trying to get a feel for where we are. And then the other thing is on the vendor reports, what is the total that the from a policy perspective, the total that we can spend in a year before we do an RFP or an RFQ for a service? And I'm particularly looking at, for example, at the legal item 12. I'm just curious about when the last time we put that out for bid was and if we have, if we're having plans to put that out in the future.
Yeah, so although that is a law firm and one would think that legal would have it, that actually is through the HR group at the agency, so I don't manage that particular function. But the answer to your question is it depends. We have some...
Excellent.
Sorry. Yes. Well. The answer is yes. No. We have some flexibility in our purchasing procedures on when we go out for RFPs, when we do RFQs and work from known vendors. There's a fair bit of work we do that's pretty unique, and we have experience with folks, so we use that. We are actually in the process of going back through our purchasing procedures and what's in the administrative code to better align them with both with current practices and with more modern practices. So this is just part of our sort of process of improving how we approach all of these administrative functions. But the real answer to your question is there isn't a fixed dollar amount at which we are required to go to an RFP. Right.
Huh, that's not
but
good.
And it depends. There's a number of factors that
Got
we
it.
Use.
So two things. One, I appreciate your saying you're examining that. When that comes back, I do think it would be worth giving the board options relative to
sure.
that subject. And if I could get an off-agenda report, because I realize Human Resources isn't here right now, just to better understand the history of this contract, when it was let last, mm-hmm. what's the total we've spent on it to date,
okay.
and what's the expected expenditure over the next year.
Okay.
Thank you.
We can provide that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair.
You're very welcome. Are there others with questions? If not, thank you very much, Stephanie, for the quarterly report.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to close item 5 and move to item 7, as I stated at the outset. So we're going to next hear the Air District's financial plan overview. Jeff. This is our precursor to the budget members, and then we will most likely move to item 6 if we have time.
Yes, thank you, Chair Bowders, members of the committee. So, starting 2 years ago, we put together an annual financial plan. It doesn't represent materials we've not created in the past. It's more of a different format, so it's a better resource. Because the financial plan is really a collection of resources, I won't have here the sort of narrative I usually have with my presentations. Rather, I'm just going to be highlighting a series of important points that are made in this resource document. And I'd also like to point out that we are going to talk a little bit about our crystal ball for the economy, especially the local economy. And at that point, I'll have our economist, Mr. Leonie Bach, come and speak to some of those slides. So let me talk first a little bit about what we did before we had a financial plan. It's not really accurate to say we didn't have a financial plan, but we didn't have this formal document until last year. And so rather, what happened until last year was, before the budget process kicked off, we would do a presentation or a series of presentations to the committee talking about policies, the financial state of the district, and that sort of thing. And that was supposed to be the setup for the budget, providing information as a resource to the budget. And that worked reasonably well, but it rather than leaving us with a reference document, it left us with a deck of slides. And so we decided starting last year to formalize this a little bit more, take those materials and compile them into what we're calling the financial plan, and let that be a living document that we update every year. So this is the first update after having done it for the first time last year. I won't attempt to cover every page in that resource in the financial plan, but we'll cover a lot of it. So I've mentioned some of this already. We're going to talk about a five-year fiscal forecast. This is the second year of the implementation. It's a living document we're going to update routinely. I'm going to first talk about history and then move to looking towards the future, our financial forecast. I'll talk, of course, about our unfunded liabilities, a very important topic to talk ahead of time about before the budget process, which kicks off in a month, and we'll review our financial policies. Again, these materials are meant to a certain extent, persist from year to year, not necessarily change every year. So without apology, it's our intention to reuse some of this and make some of it seem very familiar over time, as it may already. I'm going to talk about our reserves. I'm especially going to talk about how we used reserves during the downturn, because that did come up at the offsite board meeting. Then Chair Rice asked about that. It was a very appropriate task. And although we have reviewed how we use reserves quite a few times, it remains pertinent and is deserving of further review. And I'll talk about our revenue trends and our expenditure trends. So let's start with what did we do during the last downturn? There might be another one. We definitely did not take just some single form of action. Rather, we tried to adopt several different actions in a measured way and not have to reduce our staff. So without reducing our staff except through attrition, we predicted a certain amount of use of reserves year over year for a certain number of years. We postponed some expenditures. I always like to point out that was easy to see in our old building, that we were postponing expenditures. And the next bullet there, too, was also easy to see. Yes, deferring capital investment. And very, very importantly, we also at that time initiated this cost recovery policy. You know, it's kind of, it's amazing to think in retrospect, but it used to be that we would come fresh every year with this idea to the board of, here's what our fees are. Should they change? Why? How much? And so fortunately, back during this period, the staff proposed the board accepted a cost recovery policy that not only provided us all guidance in doing this work every year, but I think was also appreciated by the regulated community because it gives them some predictability. So here's what happened with those reserves. And this is a great illustration of why it's important to have healthy reserves, because during the downturn, we went into the downturn with a pretty healthy reserve, and it is important to compare that number to the policy number at the time. So there's inflation, et cetera, and our budget was different. But at the time, our minimum was only $8 million. We had 37. And we suggested to the committee and the board that we'd take a couple of years drying that down, but that we hoped not to go below the minimum. And by using not only a drawdown of reserves, but these other methods as well, that we would be able to weather the storm without layoffs. And we did. So we're back up to now about $45 million, which looks very healthy. But of course, I'll try to pour some cold water on that here later in the presentation, because we do have a lot of those. That's my job. We have a lot of those funds allocated already. So, historical revenue trends, no real surprises here. Pretty flat for a few years, a little bit of a downturn, and then rising again as economic activity picked up in the Bay Area. Expenditure trends that roughly mirror those, of course, as one would hope. And you can see some exceptional expenditures there as we have moved in one instance and acquired additional real estate in Richmond in another instance. I mentioned how important cost recovery is, so let me just review that policy. We, some time ago, suggested that if we maintained about a 6.4% annual fee increase, that was not the policy, 6.4 wasn't the policy, then we could hit a 85% target. That was the policy in a certain number of years. Of course, at that time, we did not foresee that the district would be growing so much and be taking on a new mission and new staff. So we continue to bring forward at 6.4%, but we're definitely getting much closer to that 85%. We also, just as of this year, added a new step to our budget process. We added two meetings of what we're calling the Budget Advisory Group. And we held the first of the two meetings for this budget cycle a few weeks back. I think it was well received, and we'll continue with that process. And this is enhancing the ability of the regulated community to have visibility into our budget process and make sure that we are also hearing their input. So on the top of cost recovery, how are we doing? Well, look, we're getting much closer and, in fact, surpassing 85%. And as I think we've discussed before, that's with a very large vacancy rate because we've got these new missions, and so our hiring target that has been approved by the board is actually quite a bit higher than what we've actually got people sitting in seats right now. So we're going to see that cost recovery number come down pretty substantially over the next year or two. Our financial outlook is good. General fund budget for the year we're in, $104 million. We're on target for revenues expenditures. Stephanie's just reviewed the second quarter report with you. Our reserves are healthy, and I'll go into this in more detail. Our minimum policy would be about $20 million, and so that would mean we've got $25 above that minimum, which is great. But I'm going to talk about some designations where we already know that we need some of those funds. And here's that. So we've got $45 million. Our economic contingency, you can see, is kind of see that's a green line, I think. It's 20. But we need to set aside some funds for a variety of reasons. Some smaller line items there, you can see, wood smoke grants, et cetera. But especially for our Richmond tenant improvements, we've got a very nice building we purchased over there, and we've built out a portion of it because we had a lease back. Let me backtrack a little bit. We had a lease back from the folks we bought it from, so we couldn't immediately start building it out, except for a small portion they weren't occupying. So we've already built out that small portion. It's already being occupied. In fact, we had a meeting there yesterday. So that's, and we deliberately made the space look and feel very much like the space here because we want our staff who are over there not to feel shortchanged or the opposite, just another good place to be that feels very much like Beale Street. So we'll want to continue building that out, and we're putting aside right now a $10 million designation. I do have some numbers from architects and contractors to back up that number, but they're still very early numbers, so that's still very much around a number estimate. So if we take all that into account, that I would encourage the committee to consider that the money available for consideration for possible use or designation is about $5 million, the bottom line there, available general fund reserves. Now I'd like to talk about our economic outlook, and more particularly I'd like Mr. Leonie Bach, our economist, to talk about it.
Good morning. So this section will cover the economy very briefly of the United States, of California and Bay Area, basically how we are doing economically and what has been the trends up to now. So in 2019, the total economic output in United States have been very good at over 2%, 2.3%, which was right on target. A little bit different from the administration's aspired target of 3%, but realistically, the expected target was 2.2, and this was a little bit above. So it signifies stable growth, barring unexpected developments such as the current virus thing going on in the world. Most economists do not expect a full-blown recession or recession at all. What they expect is a slowdown. So we will slow growing economically, but it still will be some measure of growth. In California, the Bay Area has performed exceptionally well in 2018. So the latest available numbers that the Bureau of Economic Analysis has is kind of lags a little bit. And so it's 2018 full year numbers. And here, Santa Clara was the fastest growing county in the United States of all large counties, growing at over 10% in 2018. However, excessive high technology concentration in the Bay Area is a risk, and it does lead to volatile economic performance. Another risk in the Bay Area is a growing out-migration because of high cost of housing and other. So this is how the Bay Area, the blue line, performed economically compared with California and the United States. And you see that starting with the recovery in 2010, the Bay Area overall has done exceptionally well. As far as our financial forecast, the long-term general fund revenues and expenditures are based on revenue and expenditure trends. We also take into account the current financial policies, and we also take into account key economic and financial assumptions and risks. Some of the key assumptions driving the results are AB 617, assuming the funding continues. Also, we assume that the current cost recovery policy of 85%, the target, will continue, although, as you heard Jeff say, that will be a little bit different for a few years. Also, we assume no staffing increases above the 415 FTEs, and we will continue funding our OPEB and pension obligations. So the revenue for the district is driven by two key revenue sources, and they are property tax and permit fees. And together, they make up about 80% of the total projected general fund revenues. Property tax, in turn, is driven by changes in assessed property values for all nine Bay Area counties. The current growth averages about 7% annually over the past 3 years. It's very high. The forecast assumes 4% increases for the next 2 years and an increase of 3%, which is a historical growth, 3% or less through the year five. As I said, the population growth has been a growing concern. As you see, that we've experienced a population sort of explosion between 2011 and 14, and we started slowing down considerably in 2015. So the blue line is the Bay Area's population. We became slightly negative in 2018. So the trends, even though there's a small uptick in 2019, it's still growing below California rates and US rates. And another important key piece of growing property tax assessments is prices and changes in sales. And here you see that there was a very high growth in 2012 and 13, and then it sort of slowly, because it grew so high in those couple of years, these years, the percentage changes in the following years are not as great. However, we're still growing and getting to 2019 shows that there is some growth, some recovery in housing. Permit revenues are determined by the fees incurred for providing permitting-related services to the regulated communities in the nine Bay Area counties. And so the annual revenue increase has averaged 6.5% over the past 3 years due to, again, strong economic conditions in the Bay Area. We assume conservatively an increase of 3.4% over the next 2 years, and it will slow to about 2% annual increase through year five. Current cost recovery level ranges between 83 and 85% for the next 5 years, as we will continue filling vacancies. But we'll probably be a bit below the 86% which we reached in the last year. The top two expenditures are personnel and services and supplies, which make up about 91% of the projected general fund expenditures. Personnel costs include benefits and such as salaries, health, vision, and life insurance, and other benefits. This forecast assumes a 5% increase in the first year, 3% annual increase over the remaining 4 years of the five-year plan. The 5% vacancy savings is projected for the first 3 years, and savings gradually declining to 3% over the last 2 years as vacancies are filled. We also assume no increase in authorized budget positions. Services and supplies category covers a variety of technical and professional services required for operational needs, regulatory mandates, and community outreach. We assume in the forecast a modest inflationary increase of 2 to 3% annually. Over the five-year plan. And here's the summary of the five-year financial forecast. This is, of course, all forecasts at best, based on the best available information at the time. And so obviously they can change, but this is what we think the scenario would be like at the moment. So that concludes my part.
Are you entertaining questions now, Chair, on the
final? I'd like to wait till the full presentation, if that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Leonid. So on this important slide, then, although it's an eye test, there's really just one line one can look at to see what it all means. And that's the line in the middle that says transfer from or to the fund balance. That's basically the line that's saying every year, whether we're balanced or not. And the 2021, that's just a transfer out to build out Richmond. But you can see that in parentheses is to the good. And you can see that as we project the assumptions that Leonid just discussed into the future, we currently don't have a reason to expect our income, our revenues, and our expenditures to diverge with the assumptions that Leonid provided. I'd like to talk a bit about our policies at this time. And we've reviewed these, and again, this is, it's not supposed to move. This is a resource. We're not asking for any actions here. These are existing policies. So for OPEB, we're in very good shape, thanks to what the board approved that we started about 10 years ago. We're actually close to reaching our funding target of 90%, and that will be a very happy day. We'll have a little party. CalPERS is another story. Unlike OPEB, with CalPERS, the amount that we contribute is dictated to us by CalPERS, and also they are the ones that make assumptions for us about what is a reasonable expectation of how much they will earn on the money that they have. So the obligations over $300 million, with their assumptions on earnings, we're three quarters funded on that, which leaves us $86 million unfunded. The policy that the board's approved is to try to reach a 90% funding by 2026. And we've suggested, with some reasonable assumptions, that if we were to add another million every year, and then redirect the $4 million a year when we finish funding OPEB, then we should be there by 2026. So the next steps are in March. We have the second budget advisory group meeting. And then a week later in March, the first presentation of the budget to the committee. In April, the second presentation of the budget to this committee, at which time the budget then goes to the board for two hearings. And that's my presentation. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there members of the public who wish to speak on this item? Seeing and hearing none, Director Sinks.
Thank you very much. I wanted to go back to the economics. It paints a fairly rosy picture of our continued success in the Bay Area. But, and I realize as a Budget and Finance Committee, but I'm wondering if, given all the programs and focus we have on 617 communities and others that really aren't making it in our economy, you mentioned housing, do we have an index that we're tracking of income inequality in this area? And what would you consider that appropriately to be?
So on income inequality, we're not really tracking any specific index in the area. I could certainly look into that. I'm sure there's several available. I'll definitely look into that. But
I'd appreciate that because, you know, the fact is we're fighting, and this is part of the budget, how much money are we going to have to spend on 617 programs if Sacramento doesn't come through? And it seems to me like we need to be making the case that we're just not, although, yes, we're a prosperous region, we are not bringing along everybody in this economy. So I'd appreciate attention on that. Thank you.
Sure.
Director Hudson.
Yeah, I'm on page, well, I've got it 14 on your sheet right here. I'm looking at the unfunded liabilities for OPEB, and the percentages really don't tell the story. I'm looking at $40 million funded, trying to get to 58, and if I read this correct.
Just to stop, because they're showing, it's slide 28. He said page 14, but slide 28.
Okay, I'm looking at the, there, you just went past it. No, back the last one. I'm asking about the unfunded liability of OPEB. And we've gone through this pretty much every year, and I'm looking at the last bullet, redirect to the pension after the target funding level. And as I just do simple math on this thing, Jeff, I see that if we did this year and next year, we're about 85%, if you're more concerned, because the battle last year was how fast can we shift this over to the pension? So the real question is, when do we pay this $4 million, I guess, for OPEB for this year and next year? Because if I read this correct, if you pay this thing tomorrow, this year, and next year, you're already at 85% of the level, which, you know, I don't think anybody's going to lose any sleep if we want to take a faster look at getting the pension levels up. When, I guess the question is, when do we fund this, and should we take another look at shifting money for next year into the pension after we pay the OPEB obligation?
Jeff, do you want to answer that?
Thank you, Director Hudson. So let me start with history and then make sure I'm understanding the suggestion. So what we've tried to do with OPEB is build in this discretionary funding every year in a consistent way. So it's like a structural part of our budget. We don't have to go and find the money anew. We treat it as if it's a payroll item or something that just is recurring. And the positive thing about that is then, you know, there's no disruption when we no longer need to make that payment. In fact, kind of the opposite. We can just take that structural part of our budget and redirect it in whatever way we wish. And so we sort of casually mentioned that one possible redirection of that would be towards CalPERS probably about a year ago. And that casual mention has received quite a bit of enthusiasm and has come back and echoed back through the committee. So it's my understanding that at this point we're kind of treating that as almost a decision that's been made. And if we just stick with business as usual, so to speak, you're exactly right, Director Hudson. We'll be at 90% about 2 years and can then redirect that money. And if I understood, you were saying that perhaps there could be a discussion about even paying off OPEB sooner so as to redirect it sooner.
Well, what I was getting at is just looking at the simple math that the number 58 million static, I'm the one that said stay with it until you get to 100%. But when you start adding employees and the pension funds, much obligations much higher than OPEB, if you're spending $4 million in the discretionary funds now or very shortly and about the same time next year, I mean, we really almost in this budget should be making this third bullet on whatever's up there and say, yeah, this is the way we feel we should go, if I made that clear. I know I kind of go around things occasionally.
Director Canepa.
Jeff, a quick question for you. I think it's page 5. It's the on the you know the cost recovery overview. The cost recovery policy established in fiscal year NE 2012. It's you say projected 6.4% annual fee increase.
Yes.
Is that where we should be? Should we reassess and look at our fees? Where are we? Are we in the right place? I just want to sort of understand that and sort of understand what your opinion is of that number.
So, Director Canepa, that's a very good point. In a sense, one could say that the numbers are arbitrary, they're judgment calls. The 85% is the policy, and that was arrived at because numbers in the 85 to 90% range appear to be common, and there's not much pushback on that. It seems reasonable. The 6.4% was simply the number that fell out of saying if we don't increase staff, and we want to get this done in, as I recall, about 7 years, then what that requires is 6.4% annually. Now, what we gain by just sticking with that amount until we get to 85% is this the continuity and consistency for the regulated community. If we're coming in with different ideas every year, it's a little more difficult for them to plan.
Okay, so let me ask you this then. And you feel that is the best process moving forward in terms of stability? I'm not interested in sort of what's in their best interest.
Right.
I'm interested in what's our best interest in the, the communities where people live. So I'm just curious.
Right.
The stability is fine, but I'm I'm concerned about the community and if we're at the right level of fee increases.
Yeah. I very much appreciate that, Director Canepa. Absolutely, because we are attempting to staff up aggressively.
Okay.
And so, if I may, I'd say one important element of what you just said is mm-hmm. that we want to make sure that our fees are appropriately covering the costs of that staffing. And if we get behind, mm-hmm. that's a problem. So, as we staff up, we need to concurrently be increasing our fees to match that, not retrospectively, and so as to play catch up.
Great.
If we continue with the 6.4% year over year, we will be able to meet our obligations relative to increasing our staffing in the manner as planned.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Director Ross.
Thank you. Let's go back to slide 22. This is more a question for Leonid, but he doesn't have to get it. On the assumption there on the 30%, the very last bar on the graph there, the red one, it's 30% increase in sales in 2019. Is that 30% increase, pardon my ignorance, is that 30% increase over the previous year? Or is that?
Yeah, it's January over January.
January over January. And if you notice that, so that's kind of, so just for the general public, being in real estate, it's kind of, so the reason prices are so high is because the inventory and sales are so low.
That's right.
And the turnover is just is abysmal.
Yes.
That's good news and bad news for us because at some point, I know it would be a massive undertaking for somebody to see in each county how many homes have not transferred since 2006, 2007. If that number is a huge amount, as they finally transfer in the future, those reassessments jump dramatically.
Right.
So the income's going to jump dramatically. But in the short term, that very low percentage of inventory that's turning over, we may not even get that 2% a year is what you're saying. So
it has been recently, our average over the past 3 years has been 7%.
Okay.
Across Bay Area.
Right,
so
well, that's good.
Some are much higher, like San Francisco with all the new housing, all the very expensive apartments, condominiums. It's much higher than that. But across the entire Bay Area, it's been average 7%
wow,
for the past 3 years.
Well, that's good. It'd be interesting to know. it seems like there's going to be, the good news is for all jurisdictions that there's going to be a big bonus down the road as these properties turn over. A lot of, especially the rental properties, which historically have been very long held. Okay, well, thank you, Leonid. Thank you, that's all on that one. And then let's go to the, as for the pensions, thanks, Leonid, that's all I need. You know, I've always thought that the Maginot, the pension Maginot line, and including OPEB, the Maginot line, because communities blow through it pretty easily, like the Germans did, is usually equal to your budget. If you can keep that, I mean, it's not, the optimal goal is zero, and voila, we're at 104, which is, matches our general fund budget, just magically. So I'm just, to Dave's point, I would say let's pay off one credit card first, and then let's get to the bigger one. But yeah, we do need to bring that number down, at least keep it below our general fund. I mean, nobody else has that metric. It's something I made up, but.
That's
awesome.
We
figured that.
Yeah. But I figured, you know, because we're at about 1.4 of our budget, but that's because we've hired a lot of police in the last 10 years. And, you know, I think, well, if we just shut City Hall down and did nothing for 1 year, we could pay it all off. Of course, that's not going to work, but that's the metric we use. So my statement after my long-winded statement would be is that metric would be good if we could just keep it under our general fund budget and keep knocking it down at least, you know, over a five-year period, at least 10 to 15%.
Just saying yes.
Thank you, Director Ross. Yeah. Well, absolutely, of course. And I would just add that this is with the discount rate assumption that comes from CalPERS, you know, that their earnings assumption. Mm-hmm. So we have occasionally in the past, on slides like this, provided numbers for what our unfunded liability would be with a more, shall we say, realistic discount rate. Mm-hmm. And although that was interesting and really pushed forward the point, it also just opened up the topic of what discount rate should we be using instead of CalPERS, and wasn't necessarily that productive. But we certainly can come back with speculative numbers like that.
The discount rate does seem to, another metric is the discount rate seems to match the estimated attendance at the last inaugural. Thank you.
Okay, members, we have four more people in the queue, and I want to get to the last item. We have 20 minutes. Director Abe-Koga.
Thank you. Staying with the unfunded liabilities issue, if I look at this correctly, we going to the reserves, it looked like we had, after all of our obligations, $5
million. Yes.
And that's above the 20% minimum. Has there been any thought to putting another million or somewhat to just pay down our liabilities?
So that is a topic that we, actually it's a very relevant topic for now. Historically, that sort of decision we've made, the budget meeting, which is a month from now, but actually since we're discussing the policy today, and that is the point of today's presentation, it's very relevant, and that would precisely be a modification of policy. So if the committee wishes to contemplate a modification in our funding policy, it's a very appropriate time to have that conversation.
Which policy would we modify?
So we currently have a policy.
The 90%?
To reach 90% with an extra $1 million annual discretionary funding.
If we wanted to make that $2 million, we'd have to change the policy. Is that what you're saying?
Fundamentally, yes, or vote for a one-time budget that contradicts the policy, which is, I believe, also possible.
Yep. Okay, great. Thank you.
Director Wagenknecht.
I've got a different set of questions, but we're trying to get to 85% of our permit fees. What do permit fees cover? What is that? What's 100% cover? Is stuff like what triggered in my mind is you've talked about we have an expanding role.
Right.
Is that expanding role covered by permit fees?
This is a very relevant question, yes. We're allowed to recover 100% of our cost for what you might think of as our core activities and the supporting activities administratively. So, you know, permitting, enforcement, et cetera, mm-hmm. those are covered. To your point, some of AB 617 is not covered.
That's what I was wondering.
Right now, not all of AB 617, but some of it. And right now, we're hearing what we want to hear partially from Sacramento, but it's a hard, that's an extended conversation maybe for Ledge. I'm not sure I can expand on that in a way that's authoritative. But right now, in fact, for our five-year projection, we have a conservative assumption that Sacramento will only continue to give us half of what they say they're going to give us right now. So we're being quite conservative in that regard.
So if we were looking if AB 617 became the standard that we were that we were working under, then we could work that under into our fee revenue.
That unfortunately, it's doubtful that we could work much more of it in, and I think that our general counsel might comment on that a little more.
Brian, so due to a variety of adoptions, including Prop 26 over the years, our fee revenue is restricted to covering the costs of regulating the sources that pay the fees. And we are only authorized by law to charge those fees to the stationary sources we regulate. Some of those are through permit fees, and we include in that category registration fees where you don't really get a permit, but we do charge a fee for that. Asbestos jobs, there's a variety of things like that that are covered there. There are area sources and things like that. So some of the AB 617 work is directly related to stationary sources, and that's fee recoverable. Some of it, though, is not. And for the part that's not, we are counting on currently on some money from Sacramento, which doesn't fully cover the cost of the program either, and then some tax revenue that we get from the counties. To the extent Sacramento fails to make up the difference, and they certainly haven't given us a consistent funding source, which would be nice, a year over year that didn't have to be reauthorized every year, and that's certainly something we're seeking. But to the extent they don't make that up, we're going to have to make additional dip into the tax revenue that we get. And so that's what the issue is. The program requires us to address both fee recoverable and non-fee recoverable sources of the impacts in the communities. And so we are doing the best we can to allocate to fee revenue sources what's appropriately there, but having to balance the other side of that equation.
Good. That's a good answer.
Thank you.
Others before my question? I'm gonna just only ask one of my questions, and if you could come back up. Slide 19, please. Fundamentally, I think the most important slide in all of this is the assumptions we're making. And one of them stuck out to me, which is no staffing increase in 5 years.
That was just the basic assumption that we will stay staffing-wise as we are.
Have we had a five-year period with no staff changes?
Yeah. 2007.
Yes.
We have? Because, I mean, we had that quarter report, and it showed a significant cost increase from filling vacancies. And so, for me, that is a really critical assumption to this this forecast, is the assumption that we're not going to have any changes.
For a number of years, and it's much longer than five, our authorized staffing level was basically static, and we worked within turnover of staff with newer folks coming in. AB 617 obviously has imposed new obligations and different obligations.
That was one of my follow-ups is how we're going to do that,
Well, but this 415 number you see already has built into it staffing increases to deal with 617.
Okay.
So we've come back to you a few times in the last couple of years to increase the authorized staffing level. Somebody here will have a better answer to the question of where we are in that 415 at this point. I think we still have a number of vacancies under that line.
Roughly 30, I think.
Yeah, so I was going to say something like, so that's consistent with my most recent understanding. So, but we have staff retiring and moving on to other things. And so with that turnover, we're able to stay fairly static. But to you, to the point you asked, yes, we have had periods of relatively static top authorized positions like this number.
Okay. I will ask my other question then. Thank you for that answer. On slide 14, the reserve designations, I love all the hedging language you have here, but it's clearly your preferences. For these designations that aren't the economic contingency portion of the budget, why do we have some of these? I just don't understand why they're here. Like, do we expect that we can't cover wood smoke grants or fireplace replacement grants from any other sources? Is that why this is here?
We have historically not taken those out of revenue. We've historically taken those out of reserves.
Okay.
And generally designated the reserves when the board authorized or was very much anticipated to authorize those expenditures. It's not a policy, it's just a past practice. Yeah.
Okay, it's just an, I just feel like it's something we should probably be building into the budget actually at some point. And maybe that's something for after the 4 million, you know, like a future use for that, that I can see that, but it just struck me as an odd thing to have be paid for out of that. It should be regularly funded by something, I would think. So I wanted to just ask the committee a question since we're at a point where the budget is being developed. There was a question posed originally by Director Hudson about the current policy of we're doing this iterative process of getting OPEB to 90%. But there was kind of a question, is there any benefit to hybridizing that or sharing the expenditure of the $4 million to cover both, which extends the timeline of getting OPEB to 90% beyond 2 years probably, but moves both of these forward. Is there interest in that? Do folks want to ask staff to look at that for some reason, or are we comfortable trying to get this through? And since that was your proposal, I'd ask you.
I'm the one that wanted to go to 100% along with Mark, but when I looked at the actual date or time when we'd be doing the funding, I could see us getting to 85%, and the bottom question or bullet was to move the 4% after we've reached the level. And I'm saying instead of the 100, maybe 85 is enough to start shoving it into the PERS. And that's a debate that should come up with the, I would think, down the road. Think about it now and decide when you...
So not for this year's budget is what you're saying. You're not looking
to change it. No, this is just the first meeting for this year's budget. And we're going to also have the fees come before it. I have a different idea on that. I'm not going to elaborate on it. But I think at the same time, we will get this again. And we say, yeah, we've thought about it. Maybe it's a good idea. Maybe it's not.
Okay. Stephanie, did you want to respond to that? I saw you looking to push the button. So I...
All right. That was earlier. I did want to just comment that that number that you see for OPEB is not static. It's based on valuation. And so
it's going down?
Well, hopefully, I don't know. More than likely going up. But we will have a new valuation coming up. And so I will hope that we'll have that for the budget process where we can provide a new valuation for OPEB. It's done every 2 years.
Okay.
So the previous one is based on 2017. Thank you.
Okay. Are there other questions or comments at this time for this item? No, thank you. We'll close item 7 out. And members, are you going to be willing to power through and do the last item? All right, let's do the participation and selection of a Section 115 Pension Trust Administrator for pre-funding Air District's pension obligations.
Thank you, Chair Bowders, members of the committee. This is informational only. We just discussed the policy of setting aside $1 million a year. We've done that for 3 years, so we have $3 million. And right now that's earning at the rate that San Mateo County earns, because that's who we bank with. But we talked about putting that money somewhere where there's a little more risk, but maybe we earn a little more, and also where it's irrevocable. It's only for CalPERS, for paying off CalPERS. So what we're doing today is bringing forward some more detailed information about the three existing Section 115 trusts, and then seeking the committee's guidance on whether or not the committee would like us to bring forward a recommendation at the next meeting or continue coming back with more information. So this will be a little bit data dense with a few eye tests. In that manner, to some extent comprises a resource. So I'm going to talk about 115 trusts, compare returns, compare costs. I've got a summary evaluation table. I'll spoil the surprise a little bit and just say that it's not always apples to apples. And I do kind of tend to just come back to what are the underlying minimum costs for these three options. So we've discussed this already quite a bit. We've got $3 million set aside already. And we've discussed this also. So we've got 115 pension rate stabilization programs, basically three of them. if we put money into these funds, then we can pull it out at any time and put it into CalPERS, but we can't pull it out and use it to buy property or whatever. Irrevocable. So we would control the assets. These are the pros. But they could only be used to pay the liabilities, higher yield than the county pool, usually. More risk, though, of course. And the idea is to not only depend on the fluctuations we see from CalPERS, but have, you know, think of it perhaps as a diversification of our investments, so to speak. What are the downsides? Well, we can't say for sure what the investment returns will be. And they don't actually reduce, technically, from CalPERS perspective, our pension UAL, until we place the funds with CalPERS. I don't, frankly, regard that as a strong con.
So. Both of these cons are fake. Keep going.
Thank you.
I was like, you clearly needed to put a con slide, but nothing is predictable. All of them can go down, and of course it's going to move into that fund because it has to. So yes. At some point, yes.
Just so I'm clear, this is the recent GASB ruling that says, you know, until it actually goes to CalPERS, it doesn't count.
Correct, yes.
Which is, in my mind, ridiculous and has people in my city in a tizzy, but
yeah,
it is irrevocable, and it clearly then will be going to pensions, even if GASB doesn't count it.
Yes, basically, GASB would like the funds to actually be in the fund, in the pension fund, for it to be counted against your unfunded liability.
Okay. So
however, it still technically covers it, right?
Thank you. Yeah. That helped me make a link there. Thank you.
This illustrates that we're not talking about a high-impact decision here today, at least with the funds that we've got. But if we're not just sitting in the bank, we could earn a little more money. That's what this slide is illustrating. So there are three options for the Section 115. PARS, Public Agency Retirement Service, PFM Asset Management, and the newly formed offshoot of CalPERS, which is, by the way, also what we use for OPEB. We use a CalPERS vehicle for OPEB. And that's fine. It's not with the CalPERS main fund, and we've had no trouble with that. So of these three options, we're going to try to compare them. They all have pretty similar asset classifications, similar returns. The new CalPERS option does have the lowest fee at 25 basis points. A basis point is 1/100%. So let's talk about PFM. This is their core business. Broad range of investment options, 44 years of experience, 245 plans, and we've enjoyed our meetings with these folks. So 20 OPEB clients, $4.4 billion in investments, $20,000 fee, and the fees do not change for the duration of the contract. Here's an overview of returns and costs. I'm not going to dive into this chart. It's just a resource. PARS, the Public Agency Retirement Service. Very similar, actually, lots of experience as Highmark. 1,000 plans under administration. Again, very reputable. And no concerns we could find with working with these folks. 423 agencies and 115s, $3 billion under management. No minimum annual fee, and no plan to change that. So I did suggest that doing apples to apples would be difficult with these folks. It is a bit. But again, my intention is not to dive into the details of this chart, but to provide it as a resource. And then finally, CalPERS, the baby of these. They've just formed. Of course, 115s as such are relatively new, I believe. So, right?
Yes, this new pension pre-fund and trust was started in July of 2019.
Oh. We've also spent quite a bit of time meeting with these folks. No minimum annual fees. They will not commit to not changing their fees. $11 billion with OPEB, $5 million with pension, 5 pending contracts. This is the low fee leader of the three, and it is quite problematic to compare small differences in percentage gains over the last 5 years between different investment firms, if one wishes to use that as an indicator of future performance. So here's our attempt to compare these three options. And again, I'm not going to try, with the time we have, to dive into this chart in great detail. It's provided as a resource. Frankly, in our discussions, we can support any of these options, but we tend to land with the new CalPERS option just because the costs are lower. And we've had no trouble working with the OPEB tool that CalPERS has provided us. Doesn't seem to really be affected by what the normal CalPERS pension fund does. There's the kind of the simplest representation comparing these three options. And a summary evaluation table. You can make arguments for all three of these. All three of them are fine. I think we would tend to lean towards PARS or CalPERS. So. And so I very much invite the committee's guidance. If the committee would like to have more information, more detailed information, take more time with this, or if the committee would prefer we bring forward a recommendation at the next meeting, I'd be happy to do any of that.
Thank you. Are there members of the public who wish to speak on this item? Seeing and hearing none, directors who wish to comment? Director Ross.
At the next meeting, or yep, before I make a decision, would like to know the difference between the pre-funding trust, CalPERS, their decision makers, and CalPERS itself.
Yes, that's a good point. Thank you, Director Ross.
Director Hudson.
No, that's the question.
That's the question. Okay, Director Chavez.
The only other thing I would be interested in, at some point us taking a look at, and it doesn't need to be today, is the 90% watermark that we're hitting and whether or not that should be a range that we're trying to get to, and whether or not it makes sense for us to be looking even at a slightly lower range, mm-hmm, meaning that I think because they do fluctuate, being between, for example, 80 and 90 makes a lot more sense to me than trying to hit 90 and the 85. It all seems sort of random to me in terms of the way Gadsby calculates it, the idea that everybody's going to be on retirement on the same day. I mean, it's just like a lot of fake, to me, boundaries that I want us to delve into a little bit in terms of under what terms and conditions would we change that and why or not.
A point of clarification, if I may. So that, by its nature, if we bring that forward, may raise the topic of what is the correct discount rate. So in discussing that, should we also discuss the effect of different discount rates?
I think we could or should, but yeah. And I also recognize that we may need to move forward with this irrespective of that, because I think that's a longer discussion. I don't think we're going to resolve that in time for a budget, okay, or anything like that.
Okay.
I just thought that when we had this discussion a couple of years ago, I think we've learned a little bit about how pensions are performing.
Right.
And I really reinforces for me the flexibility of dealing with OPEB relative to the primary pensions, and in part because I think we're going to see a lot more change in medical care and services than we are in pensions. So it's just got me thinking that we might be, at some point, we may have to think about how we structure those investments maybe differently than we do today. But I think we should go forward with this prior to that. It's just a bigger question for my colleagues that should, I think, should go on our work plan.
Okay. Thank you.
Director Abe-Koga.
Thank you. I guess I wanted to go back to my question from the previous, sort of tied to this, it seems like. But I mean, is there interest? Or, I guess I'm interested in hearing from you what you think in terms of looking at funding more into our liabilities if we have above what our minimum reserve is. And I guess I think about the county pool, is it worth keeping it in there, or if we get a higher return, should we be moving it in to one of these funds?
Thank you. So I guess to answer that question, I guess I'm going to just explicitly own up to, it's going to be my personal bias, right?
That's fine.
So,
you're the expert.
In terms of, we work very hard to keep a steady hand on the rudder, so to speak, you know, looking many years ahead so that we're not going this way and then overcorrecting the other way. So because of that, I'm very fond of consistent payments over long periods of time. Using one-time funds for recurring costs is generally not something that I would come forward and advocate, but it is absolutely within the discretion of the committee and the board.
Yeah. So I guess if you could elaborate on that. So yeah. This is one-time funds. It's one-time funds, but my interest is trying to pay down as quickly as possible. So why not, if we have excess, use that? So I guess I don't quite understand your thought process in relation to that.
Well, the counter argument would be then you have no available reserves for unexpected events.
Yes.
Other than your bare minimum 20, which you don't want to dip below. Right.
So I guess that's the question is, you know, and I wouldn't advocate for using all the $5 million, but is it worth another million or so to just move it in now and pay it down more quickly is the question.
Absolutely. And, you know, if that's not a policy question, but rather a one-time decision for one budget cycle, then it's not something one has to deal with here in this meeting. It can easily be dealt with just as part of the budget cycle in 1 month.
Director Sinks is next.
Thank you. I was just looking at the chart here, trying to understand. I realize apples to apples is hard here, but I see dramatically different percentages here. Is that because the portfolio composition is more equity-based in one case? How do we level this out? How much input? I mean, the questions I would have when this comes back are, unless we're deciding today, you know, do we give the investment manager a range in terms of balance between equities and other securities? How does this work, and how do we make a fair comparison between these? Yes, in terms of governance, particularly for CalPERS, are the people managing this under a certain governance? These kinds of questions.
Certainly. You're exactly right, Director Sinks, they all have different portfolio options, ranging from more aggressive to more conservative, and that, of course, simply represents the percentage that's in fixed income.
So do we have any input into this? Or, I mean, I'm familiar with APARS that, you know, every year we'll say we want the portfolio to fall within certain ranges in terms of balance.
Right. So
asset allocation balance.
Yes. They offer, in other words, it's not self-directed investment in the sense that we would be picking individual
No,
vehicles.
No. Right.
Right. We would just be picking from...
you say we want to be 65% in equities,
right,
for example, or you create a range of 50 to 70 or something, and then the portfolio manager stays with inside that. I'm just trying to understand who does a better job managing money given the equivalent amount of risk in a portfolio.
Yes.
And I don't know if these numbers help me answer that question or not.
Exactly. That's exactly correct, Chair Sinks. We don't have a basis that we can defend strongly to choose between these three options in the manner that you're describing. I tend to be opinionated, so I wish I could tell you.
So who decides for CalPERS ultimately? Is their board engaged in making these decisions?
I think to dive down into that in the detail that's been brought up, which actually is a great idea, we're going to have to go back and do a little more work.
I got it. Yeah. I realize we're short on time.
Director Canepa.
Great. Thank you very much. I think for CalPERS, they have a chief investment officer, and they have a pretty extensive team, and then sort of and they have their board, right?
They do. And Dr. Canepa, I can't speak right now to the overlap between those teams with their Section 115 team.
Got it.
I do not believe it's a total overlap, but certainly we can bring back more detail on that.
All right. This is great.
Thank you.
I just have a question for you. That was my mayor side. That was mayor. It says total fees.
Yes.
That's always sort of, I know little about money management. So you have 0.5% and then you have 2.5%.
Yeah.
It's a pretty interesting spread, right?
Yeah.
All right. And so you contrast that against the total fees for PARS and CalPERS. And I guess what we're trying to accomplish is we're trying to get a higher return and a higher percentage, which would offset those fees. Is that
true? Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Director Canepa.
All right. And so the economy is based on a cycle, from what I've been told, right? So what do we do? What we do if we have, what's our, the key word I've learned? There's risk.
Right.
So we're in a downturn. It's good times are great now, but the economy goes down. Using PFM is there a tremendous amount of risk in a down economy as opposed to PARS or CalPERS?
This is a very good point. Director Kevin, let me generalize.
And I have limited
that.
Knowledge in this area.
Well,
so I need to be educated.
Let me broaden the question a little bit.
Okay.
One reason we've been pretty calm about just leaving the money in the bank right now is because there's almost no risk. In spite of, what happened 10 years ago. That is just pure fixed income investment, not yielding a lot, but yielding something, and it's safe. And so one could make the argument that if you want to just have the simple argument of spreading your eggs around in different baskets,
or putting your money under a mattress.
It's almost that, but we've got a bunch of the money with CalPERS.
Yeah.
So if we're taking a little bit of the money and just putting it in fixed income, you could say that, well, that's good because we're spreading the money around into different types of investments. So there really is an argument to be made for just leaving it in the bank, frankly. And some of the more conservative options with these three 115s are similar to that. They're almost entirely fixed income. They might earn a little more than San Mateo with a little more risk.
Got it. And just last one. I'm sorry, Chair. I know we have another meeting to go to, which I'm participating in. So hopefully we can get a quick answer for this. With PFM, are we locked into them for a period of years? And is there a fee if we exit?
I believe we can effectively exit at any time simply by paying the money into CalPERS, unless you folks know anything different.
Can you find out? You don't have to answer today, Stephanie. If you guys can find
out.
We'll
make sure of that. Yeah.
Director Ross.
Thank you for the second bite at the apple. So my concerns about who the portfolio managers are with the baby PERS versus now if they're good and they're stars, are they going to get drafted over to the big team, to the big leagues? And where does that, you know, where does that leave us?
Sure.
But the other side of the coin with CalPERS is they have a defined set of investment boundaries. They're not going to go, they're mostly green, which I would imagine we'd have to talk to PFM saying, look, they're just, we're just not like a city investment where we have certain environmental concerns, not as strident politically, but we're just can't invest in coal. You get the idea. So I would wonder if PFM has those idea, is aware of our concerns of where that money goes. And the other question I've already asked, thanks. That's the only thing I would ask.
Yes, Director Ross, we've had what's called ESG as the acronym for green investments. We've had ESG conversations with all three of these, and none of them have a vehicle that I would ever recommend that is technically called ESG. It would be wonderful if they did, but they don't. Regarding your question about our ability to get out of CalPERS or whomever, I mean the CalPERS 115, if we wanted to, any of these, if we wanted to, we could simply use the funds we have in there to pay our CalPERS obligation for the year and take the money that we were going to use from our revenue stream to pay the CalPERS obligation and put it with another 115. So I'm not too concerned about being trapped with these guys.
Okay, I'm just concerned. Yeah. At some point, somebody at CalPERS is going to say, hey, look, our junior team's doing, the junior varsity's doing a lot better.
Yeah.
And they pull out those portfolio managers.
Right.
And then, you know, we're stuck with, you know, somebody like me and Dave, you know, getting employed.
Are there other questions? Are there other questions? Director Sinks, you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Do we have the right, I mean, what would be and what might be more helpful would be to see if for the other investment managers, can we get benchmarks on them to see how they're doing? I'm trying to get a sense of how much risk they're taking, right, and what the equity allocation, equity versus other asset allocation looks like.
Okay.
Some simple metric in order to try to rationalize these. And the second question is I would have is, I mean, I'm generally very supportive of this. I don't think we should be putting our money under the mattress. It's not the right thing to do with a substantial number of funds that won't be used for a very long time, or the most of which won't be. So I'm supportive of going forward with one option, but would also like to know if we become dissatisfied with one of these 115 administrators and portfolio managers for any reason, rather than simply rolling into CalPERS, would we have the right to find and move those, transfer those funds to another 115?
Effectively, yes. I think I probably wasn't really clear.
So like we pick PFM and then we decide on PARS, or we pick CalPERS and then we decide on PFM, do we have the right to do that?
Even if we somehow were prevented from doing it directly, we could do it effectively by using the money in the 115 to pay our annual CalPERS obligation and then use the revenue stream we were going to use to pay the CalPERS obligation and put it into a different 115.
Yeah. And there's enough going on in, over the course of the year or something that...
Right now, yeah. By far, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Others with questions? Okay, all I'll say is I heard a couple things that I think we need to just bring back. One, we had questions about the junior league team over at CalPERS and their relationship to their major league team. And what's the difference between those administrators? There's an interest to still discuss all of these providers. I have a preference, but this isn't information item, so I'm not going to discuss that right now. And we just got the answer to the question Director Canepa had asked earlier, so that comes off. And I just want to raise and lift up Director Abe-Koga's comment. I do think I appreciate very perfect budget practices and the use of long-term payments over time, but I do think that when you open an account, I think that is one of those exceptions. I just want staff to be prepared to discuss that when we come back with it, about what the available resources are, both in the reserves fund, also against borrowing against things if we need to, because I think making a meaningful upfront investment that actually does have an impact on the fees, because if there's an initial investment above a certain amount, that reduces fees. So that needs to be discussed as a metric. It also just puts us in a different position financially going forward. If we know that we've banked a certain amount of money up front against it, it changes the forecast. So I think that her questions are really salient, and I would like you to prepare some stuff on that when we come back.
Absolutely.
So, okay, with that, I'm going to close out item 6, and we've already done item 7. Item 8 is public comment for non-agenda items. Seeing and hearing none, members who have comments or other business. Seeing and hearing none. Item 10 is the next meeting, which will be March 25th, 2020, at the Bay Area office here, 375 Beale Street, 9:30 a.m. We are adjourned. Stay right here.